KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Michael Schneider, the executive editor of IndieWire, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
There has to be drama, and the extreme end of drama is death, so you go to that. But I want to make a film where no one is killed, but I just can't yet.
Prolific director Ben Wheatley developed a cult following with his intense, hyper-violent movies like Down Terrace and Kill List. His newest film, a dark action comedy called Free Fire, features Brie Larson and Armie Hammer as 1970s arms dealers stuck in a Mexican standoff. Bigger stars and a bigger budget mean the movie's got a better shot at broader commercial appeal, but it's still a Ben Wheatley film, which means a lot of people die. KCRW's Matt Holzman talks to Wheatley about his attempt to meet the audience halfway on Free Fire, dealing with casting changes and whether he'd ever want to direct a superhero franchise film. But first on the News Banter, it's official, Bill O'Reilly is out, but what does that mean next for Fox News? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, Matt, Bill O'Reilly is no longer the most powerful name in cable news. 21st Century Fox announced on Wednesday that he was out after 21 years as host of The O'Reilly Factor. So that changes things quite a bit in the rocky world of cable news. From the Fox News perspective, the most successful cable news outlet, also the most profitable, what does this mean for the bottom line?
Well, it's interesting because O'Reilly is not only the number one rated cable host for the last 15 years or so, but he is the juggernaut of the Fox News evening schedule. So not only was the ratings a boost for his program, it kind of carried the night with the spillover into other programs. So it'll be interesting to see if the decline in the time slot is a decline for the rest of the Fox News evening programming. And if that happens, the advertising revenue is going to drop in equal measure. But the larger question I have is, what does this exit do for the big picture financials for not only Fox News, but for the parent company? Because Fox News has been the profit engine of the company, about $1.5 billion in profits last year and about 20% of the company's profits. That's a big percentage for an empire as big as the Murdoch's empire. I'm not so sure that long term, the exit of a host of this caliber is going to damage it that much.
Right, because we talk about the advertisers fleeing Bill O'Reilly. Well, first off, a lot of them just moved to other portions of the schedule, so that didn't matter too much. But the larger issue and the real profit driver here is carriage fees. And as long as people still watch Fox News, and that's a loyal audience, and they stuck around when Glenn Beck left, when Megyn Kelly left, and of course when Roger Ailes, the architect, left last year. So my hunch is that audience is going to stick around. And if that's the case, then the carriage fees remain. Fox News is one of the most profitable from that perspective as well. They get over a buck a subscriber, which is more than almost every other cable network except for ESPN. So as long as that's the case, they'll still do fine financially.
Right. But the other issue at play here is the desire by the Murdochs, and specifically James and Lachlan, the CEO and executive chairman, who are the future of the company, they have a desire to turn Fox News into a global brand. And they've had a hard time doing that in a way that CNN has been very successful having a global brand, because Fox News is considered so American and so conservative, frankly, and so idiosyncratic of the American audience that it serves, that they've had a hard time thinking about expanding that globally. And I think that if you take the edges off Fox News and you take people like O'Reilly out of the picture, perhaps they would have a better chance of expanding globally and turning it into a real profit driver.
And one portion of the story that has been discussed to some degree is that 21st Century Fox is in the hunt to purchase the remaining portion of Sky, which is the big satellite provider in the UK that they don't already own. And the thought was, if they send a signal to the regulators there that they're making a real effort to be a little more fair and balanced when it comes to Fox News, then that might help them along from a regulation standpoint. But also from a business perspective, let's talk about the signal that this also sends to the entertainment community. That's something that the younger Murdochs clearly wanted to address.
Well, frankly, for many people on the Fox lot in Los Angeles, Fox News was an embarrassment. They found it upsetting and they didn't like some of the positions that it was taking and the coverage that it pursued. So if you hear small rounds of cheers coming from West LA these days, it might be people on the Fox lot getting excited about the future of Fox News. But, you know, those same people do enjoy their bonuses at the end of the year. And Fox News contributed a significant amount of money to the empire last year. And if the ratings go down, the profits necessarily go with it.
Now, turning the page real quick, speaking of things that may impact the West Coast and the Fox lot and the lots of every studio across the town is the ongoing rumblings of a potential writer's strike. Now, the writers met this week in a series of informational meetings to discuss voting on strike authorization. Matt, where do things stand now?
Well, from people we're talking to, the enthusiasm for a strike is actually pretty high. And I shouldn't say enthusiasm for a strike, the enthusiasm for a strike authorization vote, which is the go ahead by the union to authorize a strike. And the writers see that as a necessary step in the process to gain leverage. The studios are not going to do a thing unless they fear the prospect of a strike. But what that does is it sets up a very, very tight timeline. There's about a week to get a deal done before the May 1st deadline. So if they are unable to get a deal done and they're unable to come to some kind of a tolling agreement that allows the status quo for an additional 30 days or something, there will be a strike on May 2nd. And what that means is the entire entertainment industry will shut down.
Right. And even if not May 2nd, then maybe May 3rd, maybe May 10th. And what's interesting from a television perspective is the network upfront presentations are coming up in mid-May. There's also Emmy for You consideration campaigning going on as we speak. There's a lot that will be disrupted, including the late night shows as well.
Do you think there'll be a strike?
I got to say, I think it's 50-50. It depends on who I talk to at the moment. But I think there's a sense that once strike authorization is approved, that sort of puts the decision-making in the hands of just a handful of people who sort of almost feel compelled or maybe cornered to some degree that if they're feeling disrespected by the producers, that the answer will be to call something and to really take a stand. And at that point, I don't think anyone really in town is prepared for something like that.
Yeah, I think there will be a couple tolling agreements, meaning they'll extend talks for a week or two, and it may drag into after the upfront period. But something in me says that they're not going to drag the industry through what it went through 10 years ago with the 2007-2008 strike, which was very damaging and caused a lot of writers to lose their overall deals because the studios enforced the force majeure clauses that allowed them to get out of deals. It really caused a lot of problems for both the TV industry and the film industry. There are a lot of scripted projects that did not come out as anticipated because they were hampered by the strike. So I just, something in me thinks that cooler heads will prevail, not by May 1st, but ultimately after a couple weeks of extending.
Well, thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, the editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Genre director Ben Wheatley's first film, Down Terrace, was made on a shoestring budget and shot in just 8 days. Since that debut in 2009, Wheatley's been making movies almost nonstop. Next up was the horror thriller Kill List, followed by Sightseers, A Field in England, and High Rise. Wheatley got his start directing commercials in British television. His movies have devoted fans and critical acclaim, but can be divisive. They're all super violent. His newest film, Free Fire, is no exception. Set almost entirely inside a decrepit Boston warehouse in the late 1970s, the story centers around an ill-fated arms deal between members of the Irish Republican Army and a South African gunrunner. The ensemble cast includes Armie Hammer, Cillian Murphy, Charlton Copley, and Brie Larson. Michael Smiley plays Frank, part of the IRA delegation, while Hammer plays a middleman named Ord, who early in the film describes how the deal is supposed to go down.
They're going to put the guns right here. When they are done, they're going to leave. Then Tweedledee and Tweedledum can load them up into your little clown car.
And you're the first one I'm going to take down if this goes south, big lad.
It's probably a good idea, Grandpa.
I reckon.
Sure enough, things do go south, and much of the rest of the film sounds like this. Wheatley recently sat down with Matt Holzman, host of the new KCRW podcast, The Document. They started by talking about the unusual structure of the film.
You know, I think what's fascinating about Free Fire is that it is essentially just the third act of an action film. It is basically just the shootout that is at the end of a normal action film, and that's basically the entire film. And I wonder if when the people who helped you produce this movie to get the money for the movie, to cast the movie, saw the script, they thought, hey, did we miss the first couple of acts?
Well, you could think about it like that, or I think about it like it's a film with like Armie Hammer starring in it and Brie Larson, and it's a romantic comedy action adventure where roving around and car chases and probably musical numbers and all sorts of massive things happen. But this film never escapes the first scene because minor characters who should be basically extras in the film ruin it and pull it right down, and they never let them escape from that very first moment of the movie. But I never had that problem with the finances, because when they read the script, they kind of saw for what it was, which was, on the face of it, yeah, a gunfight for a whole a feature-length gunfight doesn't sound too appealing. But when it's broken down in the way it is into a series of little fights and little missions that they have to do on top of this kind of moving around of the allegiances, then it becomes clearer.
Your movies all are, they're very funny, but they're very darkly funny. In every movie, you know, I went back and I rewatched Down Terrace, your family gangster movie from 2009, and there's a scene where a woman with a pram is hit by a car, and it's both horrible and it's hilarious. And I'm wondering, A, where that kind of particular sensibility came from, whether you really truly hate people and find delight in seeing them being killed on screen, and why that seems to be such a consistent element through all of your movies.
I think I'm fundamentally pretty pessimistic and kind of a not so much a glass half empty, but a glass half empty that's rolled off the table and cut your leg and you're bleeding out, you know. And I think, for me, I think it was maybe when I was a kid, my dad died, was killed in a fire when I was very young. And I think that the social contract for me is broken, you know, and that's colored everything.
So it's an erotic acting out of past trauma?
Well, or just a sense that something terrible will always happen.
There is something that feels very cathartic about making the terrible thing happen as a way of protecting you from having the terrible thing happen.
I don't know. I don't think it's cathartic for me. I think it's more, you know, it's only a matter of time before something bad will happen.
Well, it is true. You're going to die.
Well, that's true. Yeah, for sure. It isn't pretty, no matter. It's the society completely denies it as well, which is quite interesting. But also it's drama, isn't it? So it has to be drama, and the extreme end of drama is death. So you go to that. But I want to make a film where no one is killed, but I just can't yet.
Well, does the fact that you collaborate with your wife, Amy Jump, does she share the same sensibility, and is she committed to having people die in every movie you make for the rest of your career?
I think she's pretty pessimistic, the same as me. We'd obviously share all those kinds of traits. Her point of view is probably more extreme than mine, to be honest. Mine's a bit more kind of romantic in some respects.
That's what I was thinking. Maybe you would like to have a movie without somebody die, and she might insist that.
No, I think the ultimate film, I think, that for us at the moment is something like What's Up, Doc? You know, that's our goal. That's the hardest thing for us to make, is a charming romantic comedy that isn't cynical or dark, and that's where we want to be. But we're kind of cutting through the bamboo at the moment to get to it.
Yeah.
But we're moving that dial along, and I think Free Fire does move it away from, you know, I think if I'd have made Free Fire after Kill List, that would have been a much darker version of that movie.
So your wife doesn't do a lot of press.
None.
And why is that?
She doesn't want to.
There's no contract with the, well, I guess you're the producer of the movie, so you can't.
Yeah. Right. No, she would never do it. And then her position is it's the stuff that speaks, the talking. There's too much talking.
Right.
She'd be horrified by this if she heard it.
What's your process of working together?
Generally, it's not the kind of cliche of the two people standing in a room finishing each other's sentences. It's more brutal than that. If we're writing together, then I'll write a script, and that might go through a lot of different drafts. And then when it goes to her, there's no conversation, and it's kind of comes back and it's done.
You know, the great documentary filmmakers, Chris Hedges and D.A. Pennebaker, say that they get divorced once a movie.
Yeah.
Is there some truth to that?
We have a very shouty edit. We shout each other a lot.
Shouty?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and it's lots of arguments and sadness. But when we go down from the edit suite, we don't talk about that. But we're in there, it's tough. And then downstairs, because our edit suite's up in our loft in our house. But downstairs, we're just normal.
It's an interesting definition of normal, but I'll just move.
Well, not a couple, you know, a married couple.
I see. I think it's very interesting that one of the narratives around Free Fire is that this is your attempt to go mainstream. I read that in a couple of places.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an effort to meet the audience halfway in a way that the other films were more punishing of the audience. The worst criminal in that is Kill List, which is a film that I watched recently and just found it so aggressive in terms of its storytelling and in terms of its tone, you know, towards the audience. And having done that film, I didn't really want to make another one like that. I don't think they all had to be so tough.
Mm.
So that in that way, it's a bit more a bit more commercial.
Right. I guess I can see that. I wonder if Hollywood has come a-knocking and has anyone offered, you know, an opportunity for you to sell out and make some giant superhero movie?
The thing is, because I've been working so much, to take on a big film like that is a massive commitment of time, not just to make it, but the having the meeting and then agreeing to do it, then going through the iterations of the scripts and all this kind of stuff to the thing is years, you know. So I haven't had a chance.
It sounds like you have no moral objection to it.
No, I mean, I can't. The world of selling out is a curious one because, you know, I make adverts for a living as well. So it's not like I don't shill for people if I'm paid the right amount of money.
Right.
But on the other end of it, I don't know because I've never done it and I don't have any more of an insider understanding of it than anyone else from reading the internet. But from what I see, it feels like it's a different model of production in the same way that television is to independent cinema. So the studio system's another version of that, which is that your position of power is lower down in the pyramid. So, you know, if I did a movie like that, I'd have to go into it with my eyes open. I think when people come unstuck is they go in thinking that they will be in control and then they find out, are rudely awoken to the fact they're not in control, and then there's all this friction about who controls the cut and who controls the movie.
Right.
But if you're going to take something on like that, then you need to know where you sit.
Well, especially when it's likely that in that first meeting, the studio would say to you, yeah, we want to be in the Ben Wheatley business and we love your stuff and we're going to let you do all that stuff. And then as the movie progresses, they get increasingly more frightened and the marketing people get involved and say, yeah, you can't cut that girl's head off and, you know, whatever.
That's on my contract, the girl's head cutting off bit, yeah.
Right. But it sounds like given the opportunity and if you had the time to do it, it would certainly be an interesting anthropological experience.
Well, I think as a film fan, you know, that is a thing I always wanted to do, you know, to make a big studio picture. Whether it's what I would do for the rest of my life, I don't know, you know. But really, it's hypothetical because I'm not in that situation.
Have you had those meetings?
Yeah. I mean, I'm writing an adaptation of Hard Boiled, the Frank Miller, Jeff Darrow comic, and that's a big studio pitch. That's with Warner's. So I am involved in that.
Well, that's perfect. You're getting a feeling for it. You're dipping a toe in.
I've been writing scripts on and off for studios over the last couple of years anyway. So I understand that, the push and pull of that and the shifting sands of writing a script where you get different sets of execs across it. And I think I would have had a real problem with doing that if I'd have done that at the beginning of my career. But then when I'm making my own independent films, we're much stricter about how that works. So I've got final cut, contractual final cut, and total control on the projects that we finance and produce ourselves.
Is there a happy medium? Could you make a quote-unquote studio, an English studio film?
You can make a big independent film to about, I think, I don't know, $20 million, I think is kind of the upper edge of where you can get to with pre-sales and putting it together in a proper indie way. And then you've got like another little area in between, which would need some more fancy footwork with the financing. But there's precedent for people navigating that. You know, you look at Christopher Nolan as certainly, you know, but that comes from earning your spurs in terms of making movies that make loads of money. And then you have more control as you go on, I assume. Because I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Free Fire director Ben Wheatley tells us about a casting switch that dramatically changed a character's backstory. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's The Spinoff, filling in for Kim Masters. We're listening to a conversation between KCRW's Matt Holzman and director Ben Wheatley. His new film, Free Fire, is in theaters now. Free Fire's ensemble cast spends much of the movie stuck in a protracted standoff inside a dingy warehouse. Brie Larson plays Justine, a Boston businesswoman who, in 1978, arranges for an IRA member, played by Cillian Murphy, to purchase a lot of guns and ammo from Vernon, a sleazy South African arms dealer played by Charlto Copley.
Vernon was misdiagnosed as a child genius, and he never got over it.
What does he know?
Need me to do the talking, eh, boy?
An international ass.
Justine, how you talk? As gorgeous as ever.
Well, you've put on a bit of weight. Did somebody impregnate you?
Good. Still a chance.
Larson signed on to Free Fire in the spring of 2015, less than a year before she'd go on to win the Best Actress Oscar for her performance in Room. It was a stroke of luck that Wheatley ended up with an Oscar winner in Free Fire. Initially, he didn't even plan on having either Larson or Copley in the film.
So, as I understand it, in Free Fire, you had a cast in mind. That is not the cast that ended up being in the final film.
Yeah, well, this is the world of the poster getting out onto the internet, which was from the pre-sale. So that had a cast which had Luke Evans in it and Olivia Wilde. But, you know, these things move around all the time, but there's nothing Machiavelli about it, and it was no creative differences. It's just booking. So at that point, Luke got offered some arty kind of weirdo film about talking candlesticks and were they all sing in it? What's that all about?
And doesn't sound familiar.
No, so he went and did that, and I was like, well, that's, you know, that's absolutely fine. There's nothing, I wouldn't hold him back from that because, you know, he's a big song and dance man, and not that I could hold him back, you know, of course he would go off and do it. And then Olivia Wilde ironically ended up having a clash because of Vinyl, so she had to go and do Vinyl, and that was over the top of when we were shooting.
When you have the beginnings of a cast and you kind of see the movie with their faces in it, does that cause you to shift anything in the making of the film when you have these new people?
Yeah, because we rewrite usually to cast.
Mm.
So when a new cast member comes in, we'll look at their meter and how they talk and change the script to fit that. Or if there's anything that they're bringing that's interesting, then we'll change it. So the most notably was Charlto Copley coming in. He was replacing Luke Evans's role. So that's would have been a very different performance.
Right. So this is a character who's a South African arms dealer. Was the fact that he was a South African arms dealer because you got a South African actor?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because that made total sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
you should have thought of that ahead of time.
Yeah, and it would have been the most amazing bit of casting then, wouldn't it? And they would go, why are we trying to get a Welshman to play a South African? This is mad. And I hadn't even thought about Charlto. I mean, I'd loved him from District 9. I thought he was brilliant. And then his name came up on a list. I was like, oh, my God, Charlto Copley, of course, and talked to him. And he was ready to, because he's a great mimic, so he can do accents, you know, all accents. So he was going, do you want my American accent? How are we going to do it? And I'm like, no, we should do it South African. Let's go for that. And then we had quite a lot of conversations about the background of that character and where he could have come from and why he was there. And then it suddenly, that started to make a lot more sense. So it's kind of, you know, there is room to maneuver with all these things always until it's set.
See, if this is a studio picture, you would have released the movie with the story that you brilliantly cast him.
Yeah, that I was looking all over for a South African actor and I finally found one.
Exactly.
Because DiCaprio wasn't available after Blood Diamond, you know.
Exactly. This is an impolitic question, but your films have not made a gigantic amount of money. But have they been successful? I mean, not artistically, but financially successful?
I think that they haven't lost tons of money. Because the low-budget stuff never loses any money. As soon as it's on TV, it's made them money back because most of them are financed by Film 4. So it's like...
You mean TV in England?
Yeah.
I guess they could be on cable here, but I don't know that you've made a movie that could be on TV here. They could do a cut, clean version of it. It would be 2 minutes long.
With lots of beeping in it. So, I think something like Field in England, which is about as outre and as weird as you can get, the way it was structured, it was a feature film made for the cost of a half hour of TV. So by the time they put it on TV, that's already a success. So
A Field in England was released on all platforms at the same time. Was that a good, bad, or indifferent experience? And what are you doing with Free Fire?
It was an interesting experience. And it had come from this thing where I'd seen what had happened to other movies that Film 4 had done. Because Film 4 have got their own TV channel in the UK. It's like Turner Classic Movies, but, you know, with films that they've produced since the 80s. So you make a film with them and say something like Kill List. Kill List would come out on, I think Kill List only got released on 40 screens in the UK, so it was teeny tiny. Some people go and see it, maybe not, but it didn't get a wide release, so it's tough to get people in there. But then when it gets on TV, then you get loads of people seeing it. Then it right. becomes a cultural thing at that point. And then it becomes something that's in the national conscious in a way that a 40-screen film will never be. So along comes A Field in England, which is a black and white, effectively a midnight movie, psychedelic midnight movie about the English Civil War. I can feel your listeners already excited about this. You know, this is a big commercial prospect, you know. And I looked at it and I thought, well, what if we had that audience from the television thing as we were releasing the film in the cinema? Because this film has got no chance. It's not even going to get the Kilders release. It's going to get like a 3-screen release in London somewhere. Then it'll come out on DVD and no one will buy it because no one knew about it. And then it'll be on television. Then everyone will know about it. But they won't see it in the cinema. So I figured if it was on television, maybe the splashback from that would mean that people would then tell their friends, you get the word of mouth, and they go and see it at the cinema at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that was the scheme. And it kind of worked a bit. I mean, it kind of killed the DVD sale, which was depressing. But that's not really even an issue anymore because DVD sales pretty much collapsed everywhere.
Right.
And I think it worked for that film. Now, if the film had been a bit more meeting the audience halfway and a little less difficult, if it had been like a warmer kind of movie, then maybe that would have worked better, I think. There'd be more people going back to the cinema to watch it. But in terms of a way of releasing movies, I'm not sure if there's a business model in that. I mean, I certainly, you know, I think I worked for a year and a half on that film and I averaged out about £1 an hour. So I'd have been better off working at McDonald's during the making of, considerably better off working at McDonald's during the making of Field in England.
But that, plus free Big Macs.
Well, yeah, exactly. I have worked in McDonald's and that wears off quite quick, I can assure you. But I think that made sense for that movie. Now, it wouldn't make sense for a film like Free Fire to do that, I don't think.
Because it has a wider appeal, because it has stars, because people will be talking about it.
Yeah. There was another thing going on with Field in England as well, is that I felt that I didn't want to punish the audience in terms of people who liked sightseers. I didn't want them to get tricked into seeing this other film. And because it was difficult, I thought if it was free, then you can never get the complaints from people like kind of going, oh, that's 90 minutes, I'll never get back, and all these kinds
right.
of comments.
So just to clarify, Sightseers is a movie that has a kind of a standard narrative. It's kind of a very dark comedy.
Mm. And it had an audience. It was the biggest audience we'd had up until that point. But I knew that. I knew what that audience was, and I liked those people, and I didn't think they were necessarily the same audience as some of them were. The Venn diagram of it's complicated.
Yeah.
And each time we make a film, they almost breaks a new audience.
Right.
And you'll get the same... I can see the kind of responses like, this is not as good as the last one, and then someone else going, oh, we much prefer this one to the last one. So you're growing these little audiences each time, but then that's a subsequence of making different kinds of movies each time. You know, this was going to happen.
And so Free Fire is the largest theatrical release that you've had in the US.
Yes. Yeah, by a considerable margin. And I kind of think about my experience in America is like similar to what happens to indie bands in the UK when they come over and tour in America. And it's like, you know, you're kind of quite, you can be a reasonable size fish in a small pond in the UK, but you come over here and you just get lost on your 100-day tour and no one cares.
Right.
And it just takes quite a few times to get a momentum, you know, in terms of release.
Thank you, Ben, for taking the time to talk to us, and congratulations. Ben Wheatley is the director of the new film Free Fire.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks this week to Matt Holzman. His new KCRW podcast, The Document, a documentary film and radio mashup, drops Wednesday, April 26. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider. Kim Masters will be back next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.